This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the great Neve Algar talks to me about all her recent TV and movie hits ahead of her appearance at this weekend's Fastnet Film Festival. The Mandalorian finally gets his big screen outing, along with his friend Grogu, aka Baby Yoda. We find out if we've reached peak Star Wars. And of course, all the week's new TV, reviewed and dissected for your streaming pleasure or otherwise. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. And I do hope you're doing well. I've had a busy week of it. I was in Toronto on a News Talk mission with the one and only Bobby Kerr. And I'm just back from there. A whirlwind week, a fascinating week. We got to have an audience with Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada. I mean, me and a whole load of other people, but I was in the room with them. This is an apolitical show, but that man is impressive. That man has statesman aura like I've never seen before. That's from someone who was listening to him talk and was about 40 feet away from him. I also got to meet Chris Hadfield, and I'll tell you something. You can see why he was an astronaut, a very particular kind of man. Wanted to know about the direction of microphones, lights. Just a very kind of methodical guy, a nice guy, but a very methodical guy. The kind of man whose, you know, attention to detail, you could tell, was important to him. And, you know, when you're 20,000 miles in the sky outside the Earth's atmosphere, that attention to detail probably comes in very handy. So he oozed astronautism, I might say. But of course, aside from prime ministers and astronauts, I also got to meet Kevin Kilbane, one of the great Irish and Evertonians of all time, who's now a resident of Ontario. So it was lovely to see Kevin Kilbane, Evertonians of the world unite, or something like that. But that was the busy week I had in Toronto. And this is a kind of movie and TV related thing. One of the people I was with was Ian Curran of the Irish Times, business reporter, lovely guy. He's big into his movies. And he was telling me whenever he's on a plane, he usually watches something he's seen before. Just because flying is such an unusual kind of thing. And I was listening to him say this and I thought, you know what? That's what I'm going to do. Because normally when I'm on a flight, I'm going to watch something I haven't seen so I can talk to you guys and girls about it. But I thought, you know what? Let's do that. So I started watching the Michael Keaton Batman, because it was in the classic section on Air Canada. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to take it easy and watch this. And I watched about an hour of it. And then I fell asleep solidly for 5 hours, which is something I never do. And you know how I woke up? Wine spilt on me. I literally fell asleep holding a glass of wine, digesting my inedible dinner. No disrespect to Air Canada, but plain food is plain food. But that's how I woke up. About 30 minutes from Dublin, spilling a glass of wine on myself. I was out solid. I think 5 hours on a flight is the longest I've ever slept. So anyway, I watched an hour of Batman with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. And for that hour, I was very happy. It still stands up. Now, to TV and movies. And this week in TV, I was watching this.
and she only had 30 minutes to get to the airport. So somebody said, "You should be so lucky." I said, "That's it.
I should be so lucky, 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 lucky. I should be so lucky, lucky."
And that was it. No conversation. That was it. She'd gone. Just gone.
I didn't know if the song was any good or what it meant or would it even make it. Who are these guys? What just happened? I had no idea that I was about to go over the precipice into a different world.
Yes, you heard Pete Waterman there and also Kylie Minogue. This is the much talked about new documentary on Netflix called Kylie. And the good news, folks, is I thought this was absolutely smashing. Of course, there's a certain level of curation and maybe minding what you're saying because Kylie's interviewed and has approved all this, but by God, she's had quite the life story. What you heard there was her flying over from Australia, literally on a break from filming Neighbours, and she sang this song, I Should Be So Lucky, with Pete Waterman there, who, you know, doesn't come across that well. I don't think I've ever liked Pete Waterman, to be honest with you. Whenever I've heard him talk, he is one of those music men that are a pure and simple businessman, I think. Now, you might say, well, look, that's the nature of it. But those people in the music business are of a certain type, and he is certainly of that type. But we have Kylie going through those early days, and then you forget, like, I remember this at the time, but I don't remember just the rampant sexism and unpleasantness she was subjected to, the way the world seemed to delight in not liking her. It was awful. They called her the singing budgie. And then we have how, you know, she tried to do something else, her relationship with Michael Hutchinson, how deeply affecting that was to her, her kind of slightly tempestuous relationship with Jason Donovan, certainly from his side. And one of the things that is fascinating about this is just what a big part Nick Cave played in her career and indeed her life. Nick Cave was a great guy, brilliant raconteur, aside from being a brilliant musician, very interesting, kind of philosophical guy. But, you know, he paints this picture of, at the time, he was, you know, a drug addict, addicted to heroin, and he sang this murder ballad with her, and suddenly you had this, you know, queen of pop against this almost satanic looking like indie star, and they came together and it did them both wonders, and it kind of reinvigorated Kylie Minogue. And Nick Cave has some great lines in it about how she had very little credo and huge success, and he had nothing but credo and no success, and how they worked well together. What we also have in this is a lot of heartbreak and Kylie Minogue's cancer diagnosis, and I hadn't realized just how fraught and harsh her cancer treatment had been. And there's been a lot written about this in various places this week, but how she revealed at the end of this documentary that she received a second diagnosis. So I found this a great watch, deeply affecting at times as well. Yes, the message is, you know, probably manicured, as these things often are, but it's a great watch that I couldn't wait to keep going on. And if you're a child of the 80s, 90s, noughties, even now, there is a lot to this. And it's a brilliant snapshot of her life and times. And you come away thinking, what a lovely lady. And what a load of crap you had to put up with. So I'm giving a massive thumbs up. I'm going to go 5 stars. For the Kylie documentary. And I should mention, it's directed by Michael Hart, previous guest on this show, who edited Still, the brilliant Michael J. Fox documentary, which we spoke to him about. So massive thumbs up from me for Kylie on Netflix. Now, also on Netflix, I do want to briefly mention this.
Here's a fun fact about Kevin. Kevin has a 44-inch vertical leap. And I know that because he can kiss his wife on the lips. Kevin's dad wasn't there for him because he was addicted to cocaine, which is a lot more respectable than not being there for your kids because you're filming Jumanji 3. That's pathetic.
Yes, now that is the comedian Shane Gillis roasting Kevin Hart. This was out last week. It was actually a live event, as in they showed it live. It was streamed live. Roasts, as you may know, are when generally comedians, but people get together and celebrate someone, but also kind of harshly whip them, tell jokes at their expense. They do not pull back any punches. That was probably the only joke I could find that was fit to play on national radio, because they tear Kevin Hart apart in this, particularly Shane Gillis. There's been some controversy about this. People have claimed it's racist and sexist in places, and it is. There's no doubt about that. I'm of the view that, you know, comedy is a different set of rules. So I found this very funny. The people who had the racist and sexist jokes directed at them appeared to be playing along. So I guess there is that caveat. This is not for the faint-hearted. It is very, very, very funny. And you wonder how Kevin Hart and indeed Chelsea Handler and some other people, Pete Davidson, were able to sit there and listen to some of these insults hurled at them. But it is very, very funny. But caution advised, this is insult comedy of the highest magnitude. This is G-force insult comedy, not for the faint-hearted, but very funny. Maybe a little long, but very funny. That is the roast of Kevin Hart, and by God, does he get roasted. And there's one more Netflix show I want to briefly mention, just because I watched it this week. Not that we're going Netflix heavy this week, it was just the week I had, but there is a show called The Crash, all about a lady called Mackenzie Shirilla, I believe her name is, who was in a car crash with two of her friends. She crashed into a wall. It looked like it was an accident, but it may have been murder. It's an hour and a half long. At the time of checking, it was number one in movies. It's a documentary. It is gripping. What I will say to you, though, is it is very voyeuristic. And at times I felt uncomfortable and wondered, should I really be watching this? Is this not too intrusive into the heartache of some people's lives? So I've mixed thoughts on The Crash. Clearly, lots of people don't, because as I say, at the time of checking, it's number one in films on Netflix in Ireland today. So that is The Crash on Netflix, that I'm not really sure what to tell you about it, because it is gripping, but it is also very voyeuristic. And I do want to quickly mention, en route to the big cinema releases, the Sharon Shannon documentary that was on RTE this week, celebrating Sharon Shannon. A great watch, which you can find back on the RTE player. I want to get to Star Wars, and after the break, Chris Wasser will be giving us his take on The Mandalorian and Grogu. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time. We turn to the week's new cinema releases, and chief among them is the return of The Mandalorian in his first big screen outing, imaginatively called The Mandalorian and Grogu. And there's also a new horror called Passenger, not to be confused with Passengers, which is a very different movie. At least I think it is. I have seen The Mandalorian and Grogu. I haven't seen Passengers. However, erstwhile film critic and entertainment journalist, or arts journalist, to give him his proper moniker, is Chris Wasser, who has been to the cinema twice this week. Chris, hello, how are you?
John, I'm good. How are you?
Good. Now, so just at the outset, regular listeners will know I am, you know, a big Star Wars fan. The first movie I ever saw was The Empire Strikes Back. So I'm, you know, they're often preaching to the converted. Not that I've loved everything ever since. Just for my own sense of where we're at, were you a big Star Wars devotee?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like the original trilogy, definitely. They would have been something that, you know, my dad sat us down and showed us when we were kids. Right. My dad actually bought my brother and I the toys before, or at least Santa brought us the toys before we watched the films, which is a very weird entry point. Yeah. I mean, imagine playing with a Millennium Falcon when you're not quite sure what it is or what it's supposed to do. But we watched that original trilogy and loved it. The prequel trilogy, I would like to just put it out there. Nostalgia hasn't made that film any better. It's okay to say that they're terrible films.
Yes, you know, I completely agree with you. Yeah, and I've rewatched those with my children. Terrible.
I mean, look, it is like you have to watch them. It's just, you know, it's mandatory viewing for any Star Wars fan. But it's okay to agree with your younger self that they are very disappointing. Yeah. Everything since, like, you know, The Force Awakens was very exciting, but I think we all just got kind of carried away with what we thought J.J. Abrams was going to do with the trilogy, as opposed to what he actually what he did and what we got. It's been patchy. It's been a frustrating time for Star Wars fans, and so much so that I've gone from wanting to see everything to being being okay with just, you know, being quite selective with my Star Wars viewing.
Fair enough. And that's a very good summation. And it's probably right on the exact same page as I am. But I would suggest certainly season one of The Mandalorian was the best thing I had seen in the Star Wars universe till the closing credits of Return of the Jedi. Discuss.
Yeah, I think the thing that people liked about The Mandalorian, or maybe it was just the thing that I really liked about it, was that it was quite straightforward. And, yeah. You know, there were these little half hour or, you know, at a push 40 minute bursts where here's a character, they're a bounty hunter, here's their bounty, watch them go find, you know, bad guys and fight those bad guys. And then at the end of it, he picks up this adorable little apprentice, which can be actually turned into a toy, which will sell to millions. You know, I understand the appeal, and I was quite entertained by it, and you know, by the whole baby Yoda thing. But I've never come away from any Star Wars series thinking, well, that needs to be turned into a film, because yeah. It is this weird thing where all we used to get was Star Wars films, and you know, they kind of, you know, started to suck, so we turned them into television shows and they were good. So I wasn't really kind of crying out for a Mandalorian film, because I thought, well, if you make this thing again, this thing that is best delivered in half hour packages into a two and a half hour film, whatever it is, It might spoil it a bit, and I think it has.
Okay, so tell us what's happening and it is The Mandalorian and Grogu we are discussing. Tell us what's happening in this one.
It is, yeah. Grogu's getting, or at least sharing top billing in this one. Look, you know who everyone is at this point. Pedro Pascal, who is actually sharing the title role with body doubles and stunt performers, as he did in the series, Brendan Wayne and Lateef Crowder. He's returning as Mando, this perennially moody bounty hunter who, as I say, you know, travels all across the galaxy looking for, you know, baddies and taking them in. And at this point of the Mandalorian story, he's actually, you know, he's no longer working for himself, or he's no longer freelance, but he's actually working for the New Republic. Mm-hmm. And at this point, he's picking off fugitive Imperial warlords on, you know, faraway snowy planets. As I said, he has a cuddly apprentice, that's Grogu, known in social media circles as Baby Yoda. And the two of them are doing quite well for themselves, and they have this lovely little partnership. Well, I say lovely little partnership, you know, Grogu just uses the Force and eats everything in sight, and the Mandalorian, despite the fact that we can never see him because he can't remove his helmet, you know, his enemies can't see who he is. If they, you know, if they do, he has to kill them. He seems to actually care for this little thing. You know, they have a bit of a father and son. It's not just, you know, an employer and a protege sort of thing. It's a proper father-son bond. The two of them are very much, you know, partners, as opposed to, you know, Grogu learning from the Mandalorian, as we saw him in the series. They're ahead on points. The colonel comes in, played by Sigourney Weaver, who's given very little to do in this. She used to be a rebel pilot, and now she's the one in charge, and she assigns a new mission. And the mission is basically, we want you to go and find Jabba the Hutt's son, Rotta, voiced by Jeremy Allen White here. There's been a mysterious kidnapping. We don't really know who took him, but, you know, we think he's in this city. Go and find him. Go talk to the Hutts. Figure out, you know, where he was last seen. And if you find Rotta the Hutt, that will lead you to some sort of information where we can help, you know, locate the next fugitive Imperial warlord on our list. Mm. And that's pretty much the basic premise of it, John.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And other stuff happens, but that's where it all launches off. And it's kind of normal enough Mandalorian fare from there. So I'm sensing, well, let's find out. What did you think of this?
I thought that, you know, look, we went through the plot there, and it sounds as if there's a bit to go on. There's not really. There's enough to basically put together a 30 or 40 minute episode there, but there's actually 132 minutes on the clock. So all of that, you know, let's go off and find Jabba the Hutt's son and, you know, take him into custody and let's catch the real bad guy, that takes up the first section of the film. But then you have the case where John Favreau, you know, being, you know, a very safe pair of hands, one of the top chiefs at Disney these days, he gave us the hyper realistic Lion King film, and he also, you know, created himself the Mandalorian. Yeah. He is trying to, you know, spend a lot of the second act and the third act of this film looking for other bits and pieces of plot. And I just don't think he ever finds them. Now, I mentioned that, like, the Mandalorian and Grogu, they're fantastic in small doses. Half-hour episodes on the telly, brilliant. I like the, you know, the bond between this helmeted soldier and his adorable animatronic puppet. They make for a bizarre duo, but it's an entertaining one. If you give them a couple of hours, and if you also do what other, you know, buddy comedy actioners, which is very much what this film is striving for in places, if you do what those kinds of films usually do, where they separate the heroes for extended periods, you ruin The Mandalorian and Grogu. It should actually be called The Mandalorian and Grogu Get Separated But Eventually Find Their Way Back After 2.5 hours. and that's not good enough for me. I was going into this thing expecting an adventure film, but I found there's not really much of an adventure at all. It's kind of done in 40 minutes. And then it feels like another 3 episodes where not much is happening is tacked on. We need to talk about Rod the Hutt, because I can't be alone in thinking that when I read Jeremy Allen White is going to not, you know, play, there's no motion capture here. He's voicing Jabba the Hutt's son. Even before I'd heard anything, I thought that can't be right. That's not going to work out very well. And it almost feels as though, you know, you could make a joke about the producers hiring Carmi from the Bear to voice this slug-like reptilian alien. And you could draw a picture yourself of what that would look like. Imagine Jeremy Allen White, this absolute, you know, brilliant actor, but this absolute dreamboat, right? Okay, imagine him looking like a Hutt, you know, and draw him.
It's almost like the producer said, let's find the world's most handsome man and put him in the most ugly creature
imaginable. Yes! Yeah. He's got, I mean, this is a Hutt with biceps, with rock hard pecs and this washboard six pack. And then every time he opens his mouth, he sounds like Carmi from the Bear. And he's got these crippling daddy issues and he still has an American accent. For some reason, I hope an American accent doesn't work. And he just keeps talking about how he wants to find his own path in life. And I'm thinking, is this a bad joke? I found this character so unsettling, so spectacularly odd, that there was a part of me that thought, bring back Jar Jar Binks.
Oh God almighty. Well, listen, not devil's advocate, because I got on slightly better with it than you did. Firstly, it's 132 minutes, so that's just 1 hour or 2 hours and 12 minutes. It's long, I'm not disputing that. I thought the opening set piece with AT-ATs, I'll say no more than that, was pretty dramatic. And I did think the second part waned, but there was enough that I wanted their reunion. So I'm by no means suggesting this was brilliant. And if you're saying, you know, it's in essence 5 episodes of The Mandalorian stuck together, on its own terms, if I wasn't so full of Star Wars nostalgia and paraphernalia, it was an okay movie.
Okay. How did you get on with Scorsese?
Oh yeah, the Scorsese thing was equally as odd as the German.
Very strange.
Yeah,
Really strange. Look,
I mean, I kind of found that more amusing. I was utterly bewildered by the Jeremy Allen White one, but the Scorsese one, I kind of smiled more once I realized it was him. But let's not forget, like, Favreau's done this. What's the name of that very famous arty director he had in season 1 or 2 who made a weird appearance? Werner Herzog.
Yes.
So Werner Herzog pops up. So I get where they were going with the Martin Scorsese thing. But I probably found it okay. But I don't necessarily disagree with everything you said, to be honest. So I don't know where that leaves us, Chris.
Well, I have 2 other big problems with it. I think one of them is that, you know, and usually this is something that I would champion, where you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be constantly referring to the Star Wars whiteboard. You don't have to give all of these character nods, and you don't have to be, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, remember this and this sequels, remember this and this prequel. Yeah. You know, it is quite self-contained, but it's so self-contained to the point where I just thought, I kind of want to see the other toys in the box here. Yeah. I want them to branch out a little bit and have a few funny cameos. I want them to have a bit more fun with the Star Wars universe. It's there. Play with it a bit more.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really do that. I thought it was quite uninterested in its own mythology, which is very strange for a Star Wars film. And I think the other thing is that it got to a point where I needed to see a face. I needed a face or an expression or something to let me know that these characters were having a good time or a bad time, anything. And I realized the Star Wars fans, you know, might be shouting at the radio right now and saying, but Chris, he can't take off his helmet. Yeah. You know, if he does, then you know, he's ruined himself and he has to kill his enemies. There is a section, it's barely 10 minutes, where Pedro Pascal takes off the helmet. And it's not Brandon Wayne, it's not Lateef Crowder, it is Pedro Pascal. But it's not enough, and there's not enough from Pedro's performance. And I like Pedro. I think he's a lovely actor and very charismatic given the right material. But I needed something. I had that feeling that I had when I was watching The Lion King, where it's like, there's no expression. There's nothing to let us know how these characters are feeling about one another. Just think, you know, okay, so to give it its exact runtime, 132 minutes, but 132 minutes staring at you know, a stainless steel helmet is too much.
Yeah. And I suppose I agree with you in that, you know, it was so self-contained, there was no Easter eggs, that it would have been nice to move the Star Wars story on, or yeah, even move it in some direction, but it was a free-floating kind of thing. But yeah, as I say, I coped okay with it. But what are you going to say stars-wise for The Mandalorian and Grogu?
I'm going to give it 2 stars because I was quite frustrated and bored with it. And, you know, the flattened visuals didn't really do anything for me. The fact that it doesn't really have a proper villain is a huge problem for a Star Wars film. You need a great antagonist there, and I just don't think it has it. But I will say, put them back on the telly. I will watch more of The Mandalorian if you go back to that very straightforward half-hour sci-fi space opera Western format. I will watch more of that. I just don't really need any other Mandalorian films.
Fair enough. So he's giving it 2 stars. I'm giving it 3. The Mandalorian and Grogu, which is now in cinemas for your viewing pleasure or otherwise. Chris, we don't have a huge amount of time left, but there is a very different movie called Passenger, all about, I guess, scary doses of hitching lifts and cars.
You would think it's that. Okay. And I would definitely watch that film, but it's more about this traveling supernatural bogeyman who terrorizes a couple of loved up Brooklyn hipsters who are trying to give van life a try. So you've got these two unknowable and, you know, in the end, very unlikable characters, Maddie and Tyler, played by Lou LaBelle and Jacob Scipio. And they've swapped these very busy, hectic New York routines for a permanent stint on the road. Tyler has watched one too many YouTube videos and says, I want to be all about that van life. So they, you know, sell everything they own, they move out of their apartment and they hit the road. The weeks go by and obviously someone has their doubts about this way of life, and it's Maddie. So you can imagine her horror then when she and her fiance encounter this gruesome roadside crash. You know, they stop in the middle of this deserted highway, it's the middle of the night, and it looks, to us at least, like some sort of supernatural presence is at play here. But okay, you know, characters in these types of films, they never pay attention to the small stuff like that, John. So Tyler says, look, it's just an accident. But the following day, you've got freaky scratches on the side of the van. You've got shadowy figures showing up in the rearview mirror. You've also got, you know, rotting food in the back. Something is definitely off, you know, some sort of presence that might have been at that accident is starting to follow them. And you know it's bad too when the other nomads, you have Melissa Leo in here playing this other traveler, this other, you know, van life person, who says, you never drive at night and you never stop for anything. Oh no, you did drive at night, you did stop for something. Well, then he's got you. And who's got them? Well, we don't really know who or what it is, but it is some sort of demonic stalker, and they won't stop until they've, you know, ruined Maddie and Tyler's life.
Okay, so I just saw the trailer. Clearly I misunderstood it, but it did make me jump a few times. Now that's, you know, 2 minutes and 40 seconds. So the premise, I mean, this could be great or this could be terrible. Which is it?
It's terrible.
Really?
And look, there's been a lot of talk about that trailer. If you haven't seen it, do give it a go. It seems as if they kind of put more effort into the trailer than they did with the film, because the trailer will make you jump. But this is from Norwegian filmmaker Andre Overdahl, who gave us Troll Hunter, a film that very much kind of played with the, you know, fictional found footage genre. And I thought that he was going to do something quite similar with this thing. But it's not. I found this to be just ghost train cinema. Just, you know, bargain bin horror for people with terrible attention spans. And I don't mean to be bad, but what I mean by that is just, we don't need a jump scare every 2 minutes. Those things, you know, they're more effective if you, you know, build up the suspense and if you earn them. And also if you just use maybe a handful, even less than that throughout the film, 90 minutes of constant jump scares is just too much. I just found it to be quite messy, quite illogical, and I realize I'm describing a supernatural film, or, you know, a horror about a traveling boogeyman, is illogical. As I said, you know, so many times on this show before, it doesn't need to make complete sense, but it does need to make, you know, there has to be some sort of internal logic there, and there is none.
And I would point people to 3 weeks ago, I think it is, a brilliant movie called Hokum by an Irish director.
Yes.
That was very illogical at times, but man, it kept me gripped and entertained. This is clearly not keeping you gripped or entertained.
No, absolutely not. What I will say is steer clear, but you've raised a very good point, because I was going to recommend a different horror film, and, you know, go see this instead of that. But we'll recommend too. Hokum is still in cinemas, and it's a wonderful Irish film directed by Damien McCarthy and starring a brilliant Adam Scott. And also Obsession, for me, is the horror of the year, and that is just in cinemas right now. And it's so clever and so scary and does so much with so little. Go see those two films. Avoid this one.
Very good. So what would you give stars-wise for Passenger?
Oh, it's 2 stars for Passenger, which I realize is quite unfair when you put it next to The Mandalorian and Grogu, but we'll say 2 anyway.
Okay. On a different day, it could be 1, I suggest. Yeah. But anyway, we have to go with what he says. That's the law, or something like that. Chris Wasser gives 2 stars to Passenger. Before that, he also gave 2 stars to The Mandalorian and Grogu. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Up next, the great Irish actress, Niamh Algar. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now taking place all this weekend is the wonderful Fastnet Film Festival in the town of Skull in West Cork. One of the highlights, well, 2 of the highlights will be a special screening of the movie called Censor, starring Niamh Algar, which was a brilliant movie from a few years ago, all about a video censor in the age of video nastyism. We spoke to Niamh Algar for that, but her star has well and truly risen because she is now one of the lead attractions. She's going to be interviewed by Lenny Abrahamson about her life and times and her working career, which, as you know, includes everything from The Wonderful Virtues, Calm with Horses, most recently The Iris Affair, and a brilliant show called Deceit. But we're only scratching the surface. I'm delighted to say, from a rehearsing room somewhere in the UK, Niamh Algar, for the 5th time, joins me on the show. Hi. Niamh, how are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for that introduction.
Not at all. You know, you're often described as a rising star. However, you're well and truly arrived now, it would seem. Here you are at Fastnet being interviewed by one of our great directors. I mean, it's been a whirlwind kind of 8 years for you. Like, do you think that? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you've been very busy the last few years.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky and very, very grateful for the work that I got to be able to do, and but I don't not that I don't look back on it. I'm just enjoying playing this game of pretend that I love to do. So, but yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of Lenny. So this is really special, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to chatting to him and just getting down to Skull. I haven't been down there in a really long time, and it's such a beautiful part of Ireland. So, yeah, very much looking forward to that. And the weather is to be great.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And listen, you know, I want to talk to you about some of the recent things, but you haven't made any bad choices. And I wonder, is there a pull to sometimes that people show up with bags full of cash for things? But like, when I look over all your recent credits, you know, they've been great. And you haven't really put a foot wrong in the last 5 years. There's been no dross. That must be hard to do, like to turn things down, or, you know, you're a jobbing actor. To get a good part every time is a tricky thing to do.
Yeah, it's terrifying to say no to something.
Yeah.
And you're working really hard to, you know, to act, because it's, you know, it's immensely competitive, and, you know, the pool is growing, you know, year by year. And but yeah, it's I don't know, I always believe the phrase, you know, go with your gut because your head hasn't figured it out yet. So, but you know, I have a brilliant agent. My agent Ollie, I've been with him since the very beginning, and I trust him immensely on his judgment of work. You know, and it's a team effort. It's not just, you kind of have to, you know, an aim and a goal, and we're just trying to stick to that. And I think it's following the right stories and being truthful to that, you know.
Yeah. Talking of following the right stories, the last thing a lot of people would have seen you in was The Iris Affair, which was terrific, a Sky Atlantic show. And you played this kind of, I guess, troubled genius who had a facility for mental arithmetic and things like that, yet you kept your Irish accent, but yet there was no pigs in the kitchen or pints of Guinness or any of that stuff. That must have been a part you got and thought, yes, I can do something with this.
Yeah, I think it's important to show, like, you know, I came from the Midlands, and growing up there was no one from Westmeath that was working professionally as an actor.
Yeah.
Very daunting for your parents to kind of have this kid who's like, I want to be an actor. And so, you know, when that role came along, and Neil, the writer, he was very open. He wanted my accent for that. He wanted, you know, her to be Irish, and so, you know, that's huge. That's, I don't know, I'm very proud of being able to, you know, do that. And yeah. So I don't know if that's really answering your question.
No.
It was really handy because there was a lot of dialogue, and it's great that you get to be in your own accent.
Yeah, there was a lot of dialogue. Like, that was a big shoot, 8 months in Italy. Like, you're not going to get any sympathy from anyone, but I presume it was a full-on workload.
Yeah, to get your head, because, you know, to get your head around the someone who's got a brain the size of a planet and doesn't shut up. But also to make it feel like it's accessible. I think that's the most important thing. You're not trying to outsmart the audience. You're trying to make that line of kind of storytelling accessible for audiences. But also, I think the way in which technology has gone over the year, it's become more apparent that it wasn't just so kind of futuristic in thinking, that it was very much of the now, which is cool.
Yeah. Since I spoke to you last, you were in a great show called Deceit. And I'm purposely pronouncing that very distinctly, Deceit, because I was raving about that a couple of years ago and someone got in touch with me and said, I looked everywhere for that and I couldn't find it. It's The Seat, isn't it? They thought the show was called S-E-A-T, The Seat. So just to clarify, Deceit, D-C-E-I-T, where a very serious movie where you play, you know, a police officer who's kind of a honey trap for this guy who's alleged to have committed a murder. It was a powerful show. I, that was a dark role in lots of ways, because you're this officer who's coming to question what she's doing. I don't know, was there a kind of, you kind of really need to take that off at night, I wonder, because I presume that could, that kind of role could mess with your head if you weren't ready for it.
Yeah, I think I was, you know, I'm fascinated with true crime, I think as is everyone, because it seems to be everywhere. And I actually just saw that Netflix have actually are releasing a series, or a short part series on, you know, that true life story of Rachel Bell, who was the young woman who was murdered in Wimbledon Common, and so the story follows the detective who was used as a honey trap in order to lure out Rachel's murder. And so it was a story that I hadn't heard of. I think my parents would have known about that. It was kind of before, you know, I existed. And, you know, I think researching the role, because essentially you're playing someone like a real life person, but you're also trying to maintain the anonymity of that person and protect them. And, you know, that was the whole purpose, was to provide that, because that's what, you know, the police obviously didn't protect her in that whole kind of case. And that was kind of what that shows. It was the lack of duty of care from the Metropolitan Police. So I think it's, you know, it's what I love about my job, is that I get the opportunity to research people who are, you know, kind of ostracized or could be portrayed or depicted in an unhumane way, and give them a voice, you know, and that was, yeah, that was, it was really rewarding in a lot of aspects.
But not, you didn't, you know, have to lie down every evening or anything, because it's gritty stuff.
Yeah, I think it's important to look after your mental health. Talking about homicide. But, you know, you have a great team around you.
Sure. And it's called acting, I guess, as well. So, you know.
It's called acting, but, you know, sometimes the brain and body are very good at convincing yourself something can be very real. And but, you know, I got the opportunity to work with Eddie Marzan, whose work I hugely admire. And I think I'm more at the end of the day just kind of reflecting on the scenes where you get to play opposite someone whose work you really admire. And I was just, yeah, fascinated by that whole story and the fact that this woman had done this. And, you know, she was alone in this entire period of her life dealing with this and not having anyone to talk to. And she had to be, I think that for me, it was more so I was empathizing more and more with this individual whose life I think was hugely affected, you know.
Now, they're at Skull, the Fastnet Film Festival, they're all show showing Censor, which is a terrific movie from, I think it's 4 years ago at this stage. That movie's kind of, it gets mentioned on this show from time to time. It's continued to have a life. For people who don't know, you play this slightly uptight 1980s film censor with those big kind of, I don't know what you call them, 1980s glasses, and you're watching all this god-awful video nasty stuff, and there's something in your own past that might come to dovetail with some of the horrible stuff you're watching in these movies. Why do you think that's continued to occupy audiences in the way it has?
It did so brilliant when it came out, and it also came out around the time of lockdown, which yeah. Not ideal, but it has continued to, like, it was 5 years ago. We did a 5-year anniversary screening in Picture House in central London a couple of weeks ago with Prano Bailey Bond, the director.
Yeah.
We were talking. Man, I hadn't seen it since then. And Prano's so original in her filmmaking. And she's obsessed with horror, and Video Nasties was a kind of holier that I wasn't aware of. But I suppose because it's not just one simple thing. It's got a fantastic twist at the end. And
it sure does.
And this this woman is essentially having a nervous breakdown slowly as the film goes on. But it's a kind of like a study on how much the brain can sustain trauma and what eventually that will do to you.
Yeah. And I remember you saying at the time you had to watch a load of video nasties just to, or you chose to anyway, to get yourself back into them. I'm sure you don't miss doing that.
I don't miss doing that. No, some of them you can kind of laugh at, and you see what it is, and then other ones is immensely disturbing. And you know, she's a content, you know, censor.
Yeah.
She's censors content for public viewing, and I think that, you know, taking on a job like that in Enid as the character was such a fascinating way to look at why this person is the way she is and what had happened in the past and the idea of past trauma. But it was more so like the psyche of this individual who had lost her sister and is in her adult life trying to make sense of it and trying to piece it together. And it's, you know, how she as an adult is kind of coping with that. But yeah, and obviously the censorship office becomes a kind of a huge piece within that.
Mm. It's a great watch. Tell me this, I'm going to let you go now after two quick things. Firstly, you mentioned Westmeath. People will know you're of the Mullingar Parish. I'm not sure how aware you are of these things, and I don't want to talk up to you or down to you, but Westmeath had some huge success last weekend. Did this make its way to London to you?
They did what? I'm just joking. And it was all over my news feeds. Yeah, I could hear the celebration from London. It's fantastic. It's they haven't done this in the last 22 years.
Yeah, I know.
Arsenal. So it's, I don't know what happens every 22 years is.
What age are you? No, I'm joking. So you were pleased, no doubt.
I am delighted. I'm delighted for the lads. It's great. It's great for Westmeath. It's about time. Yeah.
And then finally, you probably can't say anything. I have this, I end most conversations with people like you saying, so what's next? What is next? Are you just going to school and then we'll take it from there? Or is there anything you can tell us about what might be upcoming?
Upcoming. I did a film called The Last Days of Robin Hayes.
Yes.
That was a large film. That will be making its way out into the world very soon. I'm very excited and proud of that. And it stars the wonderful Alicia Weir that you'll know from Matilda. And it's just she's a rocketing star into the Irish film world. And Colm Meaney's in it, Sinead Cusack, Ruth Bradley, Sam Claflin, Tom Glencarney. Directed by Jim O'Hanlon, who's a fantastic Irish director, based upon the book by Anna McPartland. So that will be out soon, hopefully. And I can't say, but I'm about to start work on a TV series. And I just finished on Luther with Idris Elba. So I just finished that.
A movie or a TV series of Luther?
Movie.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And another TV series, which you can't talk about, but we will no doubt hear all
Nick
about
Brian.
Niamh Algar is going to be talking opposite Lenny Abrahamson, who's going to be asking her insightful questions about her working career in TV and movies at the Fastnet Film Festival this Sunday. You can get tickets at fastnetfilm.com. Niamh, always a pleasure, and thanks for taking the time.
Cheers, John. Thank you so much for chatting to me.
Niamh Algar there talking to me about her long career, even though she's still quite young in the whole game. But she's going to be talking tomorrow night, that Sunday evening, at the Fastnet Film Festival in conversation with Lenny Abrahamson. I nearly said Lenny Kravitz. That'd be something, but it's very much Lenny Abrahamson. That's the information I have. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. If you want to listen back to this or any show of the past 7 years, you can go to the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Leave you with a little music from the movies. This song has been used in so many movies, but the most recent one was actually the last Minions movie. So I'll leave you with the great Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears, and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.